Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, University of Hartford History Professor Laurel Clark Shire looks at government policies toward Native Americans living in the southeastern United States from the late 1700s until the mid-1800s. She examines the factors that led to the removal of Indian tribes west to territories in what is today Oklahoma, and talks about how some tribes attempted to avoid removal by changing their culture to be more like that of white settlers. She also looks at armed resistance to removal by the Seminoles in Florida. This class is an hour and 25 minutes.
Good morning, good afternoon, and welcome to Honors 186 at the University of Hartford, where today I'm joined by seven very capable honors students in an intro to U.S. history, the first half of the U.S. history survey. And our topic today is Indian removal, the removal of the southeastern tribes mainly, but removal of the eastern Indians into the west, beginning in the 1830s and into the 1840s. So we're going to move right along, but I want to remind my students today of where we've been so far. So what have we spent the last couple of weeks talking about? What's the context for Indian removal that we're in? Last time we were together, we talked about... Michelle?
Wasn't it early settlement of the West and how we got all the territories that we did?
Okay, so we've talked some about early settlement. We talked about the squatters, their desire for preemption in the early republic, movement west following the revolution. What else have we talked about? Last time we were together, we talked about race science in this period. You guys remember that? You had some pretty strong reactions to that. So what did we learn about scientific racism in this particular moment in history? What's happening? What are they doing? Brittany?
We learned that some white Southerners justified their actions through the science that people have created.
Okay. So some early scientists, doctors, physicians, and other folks are coming up with ways of thinking about races as innately and distinctly different, partly as justifications of slavery. You might not be surprised to realize that some of those also served as justifications for Indian removal, right? The notion that different races of people are innately different, which is coming to the fore in the 1820s and 1830s, is definitely part of why Indian removal happens in this moment. We've also spent a lot of time since we got through the revolution talking about this thing called the market revolution. Right, Dan, can you tell me a little bit about the market revolution?
The market revolution was a start to capitalism, pretty much.
Okay, so the rise of modern capitalism.
And it brought more corporations in, and the tradesmen were starting to be pushed away a little bit.
Okay, so working class people no longer believe that they can ascend through the ranks to be from apprentice to journeyman to master, and now they're facing a life of wage work unless they're one of the lucky ones who has the capital to invest in this new economy. So there's a lot of economic pressures on Americans happening in this moment too. The market revolution has unsettled the way that people traditionally lived out their lives and made money. So we've got something going on with race and something going on with markets. We've got people moving west in search of land. Any other important context, you think?
The social order is becoming more distinct. Like, you really start seeing the difference between the working class and the middle class, as well as those who are the elites.
Okay. We've got a part of the change of the market revolution is this increasing sense that there are distinct social classes and sort of social and cultural beliefs that go along with those. The other thing we've talked about in the last couple of weeks is this thing called manifest destiny, right? This ideology that Americans begin to espouse. Anybody remember some of the pieces of manifest destiny, Josh?
It's God's plan to let us as the Americans go from sea to shining sea.
Okay, so we're destined to spread over the entire continent. We don't end up taking Mexico and Canada, but it's possible, it seems, in 1815 or 1820 or 1830 that we might do that. Partly it's God's decision because he loves us so much. What else?
We learned that, like, the Americans are in their stories, they're always the ones that are being oppressed. They're always the ones that are the victims. And it's never anything that they do that's wrong. Everyone else is wrong.
Okay, so white squatters, for example, see themselves as oppressed by land speculators and Indians who attack them and government officials who won't give them preemption, but never think of themselves as the invaders of Indian lands, for example. Okay? Other pieces of Manifest Destiny you guys remember? Mary?
They thought that national expansion would mean the expansion of freedom as well.
Right, that national expansion was seen as progress, as, you know, good for everyone, that God wants us to do this in part because it will mean the expansion of liberty and democracy and freedom for everyone. And it is the expansion of opportunity, in particular for white Americans and the immigrants who in the 20th century will become increasingly white. So I wanted to start this class on Indian removal with a couple of images. This painting by John Gass from 1872 is one of them. And the next image I'm going to go to is this one. But we're going to start with American progress. Take a minute and look at this painting and tell me what you see. Read it like a primary source. What do you think its message is? What do you know this about, the story that it's trying to tell? Emily.
It shows how the white settlers are moving in and they're kind of rooting out the savageness of the Indians, and that, like, industrialism, like the train you see coming through, is bringing out the old and bringing in the new civilized. Yeah.
Okay. So we've got white settlers moving in, and we've got some savages here. How do we know that these are white settlers and these are savages, other than skin tone?
The way they're dressed.
Or not dressed,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. These folks are clothed, and they also all appear to be male, right? And these folks are not clothed, and this looks like a couple of women, given the prominence of their breasts in this image. Okay. What else is going on? We've got some progress, right? Some trains coming through, bringing the goods of all those markets. We talked a little bit about how transportation expands with the market revolution. What's going on in the background? Brittany?
It seems as if it's like good and bad, because it's like, it's the cloudy, it looks almost like a thunderstorm, and then it's like clear, bright skies.
All right, so the light is on this side, which would be the east. Right, if we were reading this like a map. And the dark is on the west side. And over here we see, you know, ships in a harbor, so perhaps the sea is this way along the east coast. And here we have perhaps the high peaks of the Rockies, right, the mountains. So there's a visual argument here about moving east to west. What would you say that argument is? It's not just a coincidental thunderstorm, I'm going to suggest. Michelle?
Kind of the best part, and they're trying to like push that on the west and bring their customs and what they think is right to the west side and kind of make it very similar to these.
Progress moves from east to west, right? Progress moves from east to west. It's our manifest destiny that we will bring all of the government and technological and religious institutions of white Anglo-Saxons into the west, and that will be progress, that will be good, that will be the spread of democracy. So you see all these different methods of transportation also seem to be laid out. There are people traveling by wagon and stagecoach and train. There are ships back here. And what do you notice about the animals in this image? What animals do you see in the eastern civilized part of the frame, and which ones do you see in the western uncivilized part of the frame?
Horses as opposed to buffalo.
Okay. I mean, these folks are riding horses, as are these, right? But these folks also, what are they doing to the landscape underneath them?
Plowing it.
They're plowing it, right? So these folks look like they're just running from something, maybe from white settlers, although that's probably not what he intended in the original, right? But these folks are settled, right? They're farmers. So what's the message overall at the end of the day? Maris, what's this painting trying to tell us?
That white folks are civilized and they're kind of spreading civilization to the savages in the West.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So who lives here? Take a look at this photo. You might know the answer to this question depending on your exposure to Indian history. But if you don't, just take a look at this photograph and tell me who you think this is. Where do you think this house is? Who do you think, what kind of person do you think lives in this home? Mary, what do you think?
Someone that's wealthy.
Someone that's wealthy, okay. Because it's big,
yeah.
It's a little ostentatious.
Looks nice, well built.
What else do you notice about this photo? There are lots of people standing in front of it. I don't know if you can tell in this light what the differences are between those people, but what do you see?
It kind of looks like a plantation house.
In fact, it is a plantation house. Okay, so it's the home of a wealthy planter. And I'm guessing that you suspect that some of these folks are black and enslaved, which is what made you say plantation house. Okay. And perhaps these are the folks who live in the house. What else do you, if you had to guess where it might be or who it might be, what would you guess?
South Carolina.
South Carolina, okay. Somewhere in South Carolina. And who do you think lives there? You don't have to tell me a person, but if you think plantation house, who lives inside a plantation house? The owners of the plantation, and they're probably white.
White, wealthy, yeah, Anglo-Saxon.
Okay, the folks that are civilizing the wilderness, right? This is actually the cottage, Rose Cottage, which was Cherokee Chief John Ross's home in Park Hill, Oklahoma, circa 1860. Right? Here's another one. This is Malmaison, which was Choctaw Chief Greenwood LaFleur's residence in Mississippi, built in 1852. Michelle.
Are these the houses of, it says chief, are they Native American?
They are Native American.
And they have, wow.
They are Native American.
Are these guys the sellouts?
John Ross was not a sellout. Greenwood LaFleur maybe was, right? But the what's the point, right, of these images contrasted against this one? Michelle.
You see that the savages actually, they live in really nice houses. They can obtain the living status of a typical white man or woman.
But, or an atypically elite one. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And whereas in the other one, they're shown as just running away from either white settlers or just, you know, reaping havoc across the plains. And they're just shown as the typical savages that they were thought of.
All right. So as it turns out, Native Americans undergo many changes because of the market revolution as well. And because of assimilation policies, which we'll talk more about in a minute, many, not all, but many adopt cash crop agriculture. They have owned slaves for a long time. They begin to use slaves on plantations much like whites. They adopt some pieces of Christianity. They take advantage, for example, of mission schools for their children, where their children might learn English. So there's there are ample examples, not all of them this ostentatious, of the ways in which Native Americans changed over time, progressed, we always put that word in quotes in this class, right? But progressed over time, much like whites did. They did, in fact, assimilate. So the question is, why did we remove them? I want to go now to the chapter you read from Lowen's book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. We actually read this for the last class, but didn't get much of a chance to talk about it. And I wanted to talk about it briefly now, this chapter called Red Eyes, which is the chapter about Indian history in this book, because I think it does some important work of undoing some of those stereotypes of Native Americans that we have to undo if we're going to think about removal from red eyes instead of white ones, for example. So what did you think in general about this chapter? What were some of your reactions to it? You guys recall?
It kind of Emily. Seemed as if the old ideas of scientific racism and just how the Native Americans weren't as bright or civilized as Europeans were, it kind of made its way through the textbooks and is still there because they were often described as, oh, they couldn't adapt to the new culture or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So he's taking textbooks to task through the whole book. But what he says about Native American representations in textbooks is that they seem pretty retrograde, right? They might not be unequivocally labeled as savage, but most images of them are still of either Native Americans at war or Native Americans in some sort of, you know, state of semi-nudity, right? Next to fully dressed whites, for example. Joshua?
They're writing it from the European perspective, and they're not giving the Native American perspective at all. I didn't know that that there were some chiefs living in like normal like living houses like we would.
Uh-huh.
And it's just that's not at all what we learned in high school.
Okay. So high school you learn about teepees and log houses maybe, right?
Long houses.
Uh-huh. Michelle?
I was just like Josh, I was kind of shocked because you don't really think anything of it when you're learning it in high school or in middle school. Like, you're just taught American history, and then you come to like a class like this and you realize that they're actually purposely not purposely, but you know, they're just intentionally not including any kind of Native American history because that's not about us. Like, they just depict them in certain ways, and it was really shocking just to see that there actually can be people who live in plantations that are Native American, and that they don't all live out in little huts and teepees and little groups by themselves.
Uh-huh. And then, in fact, they have history just like we do. I mean, one of the hardest stereotypes to overcome about Native Americans is this sense that real Indians have no history and still live today, or should, if they're real Indians, live today just like they did in 1750, right? I went to a Lumbee homecoming in North Carolina, which is a Native American community there, last summer, and saw a t-shirt that said something like, "Where's my braid? Where's your tricorn hat?" Right? Like, why do you assume that I have to look like an Indian if you don't look like a white guy looked in 1800? Right? But we treat them, we expect Native Americans somehow to be these timeless people with this culture that's been preserved and untouched in some way, if they're real Indians. So that's definitely one of the challenges. The other interesting thing that Lowen says in this chapter is that this is actually our history too, right? That there are many things we have adopted from Native American cultures that no longer seem Native American at all. Emily, you're nodding. Do you remember an example?
Yeah, like the League of Nations. And I remember talking about this a while back in the classes. The union of the states may or may not have been an idea of the League of Nations.
The Iroquois League, uh-huh.
Yeah, how they banded together as separate groups but made a agreement to be together.
Mm-hmm. And that there's some suggestion that when Franklin suggested the Albany Plan of Union before the Revolution, that was based on the Iroquois League. So there, you know, and there are everyday examples like chili in Texas and all kinds of foods that we eat that technically began as Native American foods, right? They're not things Europeans ate before they came. So this is our history. In a whole variety of ways. And certainly Andean removal is our history.
And the League of Nations is completely like our country because they had five originally and then they had another. They added the sixth.
The Iroquois League, right.
Yeah.
They
and
added
then
a
we,
sixth.
We keep adding on states.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think is his main argument in this chapter? Aside from the fact that textbooks get Indians wrong, what's the story they tell that's not correct? Do you guys remember this? It's very, very relevant to today's topic. What do you think is his major argument, his main point?
Well, he concludes by saying we should not wallow in our wrongdoing, but just to understand the wrong that we have done, and just make sure that we give people voices in the future.
Mm-hmm. That if we look at American history through Native American eyes, it looks quite different. And the point is not just to make white people feel bad, right? None of us have actually settled on Indian land when it was still Indian land, right? Someone did that before us. But to recognize that this happened and that not talking about it is not a solution either, and is not only wrong to Native Americans today, but it gives us a very inverted version of our own history. One of the things he says, and this is a quote that I think the group who led discussion last time wanted to bring up, was that it's time for textbooks to send white children home, if not with red eyes, at least with thought-provoking questions about how this happened, about how is it that Native American chiefs live in things that are in fact plantation houses, but we remove many of them anyway. This image, Maris, I see you laughing at it, is an image that I first saw on a t-shirt in New York City and then bought on a t-shirt at the Catawba Reservation in South Carolina. Tell me about this image and what it does. Right? I think it's a great example of seeing the world through red eyes and is a little bit humorous at the same time. So what's the message of that image? Dan, what do you see?
Well, it's pretty much saying that they've been fighting off other people since 1492. They've been there. They've already settled in, but the Europeans came over and they're invading on their territory pretty much. And they're taking much of what they've already set up, and they have it easy once they do that. So.
Okay, and what do you think about the use of the term homeland security? Because that's the joke, right? The play on words, the double entendre, is homeland security. Michelle?
Because that's an issue that we have, and we're worried about invasion and terrorist attacks, so it's kind of relating it to a present modern day conflict by showing that it's been happening since 1492. It's been happening maybe to different people, but it's still going on.
Okay.
and that it's a universal like theme for everybody, and it's something that ties us all together because we all have to deal with it.
All right, so maybe it ties us all together. On the other hand, I think it makes two pretty strongly political statements. One, that North America was whose homeland?
Indians,
right? If they're securing their homeland, then it's not ours, right? Not ours to secure. And secondly, fighting terrorism since 1492, which suggests that Europeans and American settlers were
terrorists,
right? Not settlers, right? I mean, and that, you know, Lowen says in his chapter, it would be, you know, we in textbooks you hear about Indians attacking settlers, and the assumption is always that settlers are white and that Indians somehow aren't settled. Right, but in he suggests it would be perhaps more correct to call white settlers invaders, right? That settlers were attacked by white invaders, but I don't expect textbooks to say that anytime soon. The overall storyline he tells us in most American history textbooks is this. We tried to Europeanize the Indians. We tried to assimilate them. They wouldn't or couldn't do it, so we dispossessed them. We took their land away. And the problem is that that's a myth, right? The problem is that Native Americans didn't stand in the way of progress. They experienced progress just like white Americans did. Their defeat was not inevitable, although the myth is certainly that it was. Manifest Destiny made everything seem pretty inevitable, according to the progress narrative. But in fact, things could have been different. One of my favorite parts of this chapter is when he talks about how this wasn't inevitable and other things could have happened. Do you remember that part of the chapter? He makes several suggestions about how things could have gone differently. And we don't have to go deep into them, but does anybody remember any of the alternatives to removal? What else could have happened? Maris, what else could have happened?
They refused to be assimilated or assume our culture then.
But did they?
No.
Not the majority.
So you think the majority refused to be assimilated?
Yeah.
I don't think that's true, actually. I don't think that's true at all. The Cherokees in Georgia, right? Perhaps the most famous story of Indian removal we hear about, the Trail of Tears, adopted many of the planks of assimilation. In fact, they were a little too successful at it, right? So the problem is not that they couldn't or wouldn't be assimilated. The problem was, go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, I found it funny in the part when he said, in Roanoke, the lost colony, no one ever like suggests that the colonists could have become a part of the Native American tribes, but they
of
were just
lost.
Of their
own free will,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess in response to your question, I think it wasn't that they couldn't assimilate and couldn't become part of our culture, is that we wouldn't accept them as anything such.
And that's exactly right.
We kind of made it look like they just didn't want to do it because we didn't want to look bad.
He tells the story of the, I think it's Cherokees who go to Jefferson and say, we want the same rights as whites. We want you to recognize that our property belongs to our family and that we have the rights to slaves and to land. And Jefferson says, yes, you should do all of those things and assimilate into white culture, but then does nothing to protect their rights, right? Sends them on their way. So it's not that they don't assimilate, it's that whites will never accept them as Native American. And when they prove to be successful, whites say, wow, that land looks pretty good. We'd like that now. Thank you. You're not white. You're not one of us. You can't stay. And that's what happens repeatedly. And the context of that is scientific racism, this belief in innate difference. They couldn't possibly become like us because science tells us so. Manifest destiny, right? God has destined us to spread across this continent and change everything in our wake and to reap the benefits and the opportunities there. So Indians do assimilate, right? What happens to their lands, for the most part, is the truth is that we dispossess them. Some of the other alternatives that Lowen suggested could have happened. There's intermarriage, right? Certainly there were many, many, we talked about this from the colonial period, right? Lots of Europeans who intermarry with Native Americans to get access to the fur trade and other parts of the North American economy. And that certainly continues to happen. But increasingly with scientific racism, intermarriage becomes less and less legal and possible.
So those families that were living there, well, I mean, a lot of them weren't English, but I'm sure that a lot of families like that intermarried from the French and the Spanish perspectives are still living here. So
sure.
Then are they being like tortured by other people and being thrown into the Native American category now?
That depends. right? Because race is not, doesn't tell us, you know, isn't based in sort of any genetic truth about people. It's about culture, right? So it depends on whether those families call themselves Native Americans, live among Native Americans, or live among Europeans, right? That cultural shift that happens. Another thing he suggests is that in some places, and the Lumbee in North Carolina are a great example of this, there are these triracial isolates. There are places where people recognize that there are whites, blacks, and Indians, and they all have a place in the social order, of course, a hierarchical one that's unequal. But it was possible for them to be part of the social fabric of a community. It's also possible that we could have just given them rights and let them stay, right? I mean, that was possible. Is that impossible? No, it was a choice, right? So the question that Michelle and the rest of the group from last time asked and wanted to talk about in class is, what would textbooks look like if they didn't look like this? What if they did try to see some of American history from Native American perspectives? What would they look like? What would be different about an American history textbook that saw some things through red eyes, through an Indian perspective? Brittany, what do you think?
If they saw it through red eyes, it certainly, I feel like it would definitely be more complex. Like, it wouldn't just be like, okay, chapter one's on We Came to America, chapter two is, oh, look at this, we kicked out the Indians. I definitely think it'd be, like, more detailed.
Okay. It would be more complex. You'd have to represent more than one perspective.
And definitely, it wouldn't just be about, like, two tribes. It'd be about everybody. Mm-hmm. Because them being Native Americans, they'd want to represent everyone.
Okay. So the other difficulty is that textbooks try to talk about Native Americans very briefly, and so they talk about them all as if they're the same, right? Michelle?
I think that the view on wars in general, like, you know, like the French and Indian War, any kind of wars that we had with Native Americans would be totally seen in different perspectives. Not only would this probably the stories be longer, because then you'd have to see it through what the Native Americans thought happened and how we attacked them, and then mm-hmm. they would say how we attacked and how they attacked us. Mm-hmm. And it would just get very detailed and, I guess, opinionated on both sides.
Mm-hmm. But, right, Lowen would like that, right? Because he's told us from the beginning of the semester that history is a series of debates, not a series of settled facts. Mary?
I was going to say something about that. Like, in the beginning of the book, I think Lowen had said how some things in history textbooks don't seem to make sense, like the piece is missing, like you just jump to this and kind of try to make something up to make it sound like, okay, that's how it went. And if you added all the, what really happened with the Indians, I think things would make more sense. Mm-hmm. Not that they don't make sense, but you would just see a big difference mm-hmm. in how history is told through textbooks. Mm-hmm.
So it would be more complex and maybe more interesting, right? And that cause and effect relationship that's so important to understanding history, you wouldn't lose sight of all the causes in talking about the effects as if they were inevitable, right? Joshua?
It seems that history books are taught from the perspective of Europeans for Europeans.
Or for European Americans, yeah.
For European Americans, and they realize, oh, wait, we have this perspective and this perspective. Let's try and throw that in really quickly. And it's wrong because mm-hmm. it's from their perspective, when in reality, a textbook should be written by everybody. And it should be, it's just not. Mm-hmm. It's stupid.
No, but you're absolutely right. That part of what's happened is we had this narrative of American history, and then we had a lot of social movements that affected who went and got PhDs in history and other things. And other disciplines. And then those people wrote history. There is lots of Indian history, right? It's out there. And women's history and African American history and, you know, the history of Hispanics in America and on. And now we add those things in, like, you know, putting salt and pepper on the dish once it's finished. But the dish is already made, right? It hasn't unmade any of this progress narrative. It hasn't changed any of the major story. So it just becomes these little side notes that then kind of don't make sense. Right? Because the main narrative hasn't been disrupted. That's exactly right. So I want to give you a little bit of background. I want to move into talking about the documents that you read today. You read two documents about the Seminole removal from Florida. And I picked Florida in part because it doesn't get as much press as Cherokee removal. You may have been exposed to Cherokee removal or another Indian removal before. And it's very much tied up with the politics of slavery, which is something we've talked about throughout this whole class and are moving into, and so it helps us think about that. But beginning after the American Revolution, settlers flood across the Appalachians, right? Remember, we didn't like the proclamation line of 1763, we, the Patriot Americans. We wanted to move further west, and so they begin to do that. And you won't be surprised to know that as soon as that happens, violence begins to ensue as well, right? That there are conflicts between white settlers and the Native Americans who had asked the British king for protection from encroachment before the Revolution. So in the 1790s and into the 18-teens, right, during the War of 1812, there's a series of wars largely focused around the Ohio country, the part of the continent that we had won from France in the French and Indian War. And Shawnee, Chippewa, and Miami lose much of the Ohio country without any support from Great Britain behind them. Tecumseh then goes to Indiana and tries to create a resistance movement among a variety of different Native American groups, and then they're defeated by the end of the War of 1812. And then in 1814, Andrew Jackson defeats the Creeks, and the Creeks begin the removal process from the Southeast. So this has been happening long before the Indian Removal Act of 1830 and the context of what's happening in that moment. What changes, however, by 1830, the thing that makes the difference, is that previously the U.S. had pursued expansion with honor, right? The founding fathers, Washington and Jefferson and Monroe in particular, had been in favor of expansion with honor, by which they meant an expansion of white settlement that wouldn't harm Native Americans. They didn't want to be the bad guys. They just fought a war against a colonial power. They didn't want to be a colonial power. So they recognized Native American nations as sovereign, and distinct from the United States as folks with whom they have to make treaties. They negotiate treaties with them, get them ratified in Congress, and the treaties are really a way to avoid war and conflict, not only because they don't want Native Americans harmed, but mainly because those things are extremely expensive. I think it's in Lowen's book that he tells us that something like 80% of the federal budget under George Washington is spent on fighting wars with Native Americans over land. So this is a really big policy decision. They're seeking to assimilate the Indians, and that's the piece of this that's so important to our story today, right? That this expansion with honor includes this plank, that the idea is that we should assimilate Native Americans. And eventually, I mean, Jefferson even says this frankly in Notes on the State of Virginia, that if we intermarry with them, eventually we'll sort of breed them out, right? We'll intermarry with them and they will become parts of our family, and eventually they'll all just become like us. They'll become white. That, by the 1830s, is not thinkable anymore, in part because of scientific racism, right? Because once you have race linked to innate differences, then intermarriage doesn't promise the same thing. They're thinking at the turn of the century, right after the Revolution, that the overcoming of cultural differences is possible because it's not an innate difference. Of course, they want Indians to civilize or to assimilate. They called it civilization programs. And of course, civilization meant contemporary American culture. They wanted Indians to look just like the white people of 1815 or 1820 did. And all of this is partly about not wanting to be a colonial power, not wanting to be immoral colonizers, not wanting to be the bad guys, and partly because it's much cheaper than constant warfare or expulsion. To negotiate with Native Americans and invite them to assimilate is a better policy than attempting to exterminate or remove them in the early republic. So what does assimilation look like? Right? What does this look like, and how do Native Americans do this? I mean, the promise is if the Indians will adopt white ways, they'll be allowed to stay. And many of these civilization policies are adopted and adapted by Native American groups beginning in the 1780s. So that by the time we get to 1830, you have homes like the ones that we just saw, and also Native Americans living in log cabins just like white settlers live in log cabins, and farming just like white farmers farm. Many of the five civilized tribes in the Southeast, who are often cited as the best of the assimilators, although they're not the only ones, adapt some or all of these practices, but they do that in culture-specific ways, and I'll try to give you some examples of that. So the five civilized tribes, which is what whites called them because they were so good at becoming civilized and assimilated, are the Cherokee, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, the Creek, and the Seminole, and in a minute you'll see a map of where they were located in the Southeast and where they're moved to. Many of them, in particular the Cherokee and the Seminole, adopt race-based slavery. So they have African-American slaves. And cash crop agriculture, the cash crop agriculture that goes along with that, that's how people like Chief Ross and Greenwood LaFleur can afford those homes. They begin to accumulate capital just like white plantation owners begin to accumulate capital. So we begin to see a class system happening among them. And that will prove very fractious during treaty negotiations, as Maris has suggested. There will be some sellouts. But there is also an increasing then hierarchy and delineation that looks more like white society. There had always been hierarchies among Native American groups, but they were different than there had been before. They also adopt, with some differences, Anglo gender divisions of labor. At the beginning of the semester, we talked about how Native American women were the farmers and the men hunted, the sort of life-giving and life-taking gender roles. And whites, in favor of assimilation, are sure that this is one of the major things that must change. Indian men must start farming, and Indian women must start acting like white women. They must start become more domestic. They can have gardens, but they can't have farms, right? They can do the dairying and take care of the children and do the sewing and maybe weaving, but they can't continue to hoe the corn. Native Americans accept that to a certain extent, but there is ample evidence that among the Cherokee, women continue to hoe the corn, but men take over livestock responsibilities. And with the accumulation of capital, many of these groups accumulate more and more herds. And so men, sort of as a corollary to hunting, become the people who take care of the livestock, while women may still do some of the farming. Men may take over cash crop agriculture, but women may continue to do the subsistence agriculture, the growing of the food that the people actually eat. Patrilineal inheritance, right? As these groups begin to accumulate more and more property, they become concerned about how to preserve that property for the next generation. And so instead of things being passed through the mother's line, through matrilineality, as it had been historically, they adopt white ways, which is that sons inherit from fathers. That changes forever the relationships between Native American men and women. They begin to own property privately rather than as members of a clan or a tribe or a group. So they had understood that people owned rights to do certain things with land or homes or implements, but that changes to be a personal individual property, right? So these things look American. They, to a certain extent, accept Christianity, but often what they accept from Christian missionaries are the services that they offer in terms of teaching their children English and making their children literate. They understand that their children are going to have to make their way in a world much more controlled by whites, and so they're happy to let the Moravians in North Carolina, for example, educate their children. That doesn't mean that they all accept Jesus as their personal Lord and Savior, although perhaps some did. They adopt centralized constitutional governments, right? The Cherokee write down government documents and adopt a new set of hierarchies in response to this. And the Cherokee write down their language. Sequoia comes up with the Cherokee syllabary, a way to write down the sounds that you made in Cherokee. So these are some of the things that all of these groups adopt in reaction to this invitation to assimilate and become fully citizens among American whites. But in the 1830s, this goes out of style, right? Americans, not Indians, but Americans renege, in a sense, on the assimilation promise for a couple of reasons, right? What's the context of the 1830s? We've got the squatters, right? The settlers moving on to public lands and those buying lands themselves. So increasing white demands for agricultural land. And why do they want more land? The market revolution, cash crops, opportunity. Increasing population. The 1830s is also a turning point in debates over slavery, right? By 1830, paternalists are defending slavery as a family institution. These are all my people, a slave owner might say, a male head of a slaveholding household, and I care for all of them. That's called paternalism. Abolitionists begin to attack it on moral as well as political grounds. So we've got this heating up over slavery, we've got more demand for land, and we've talked in the past about how as we add land, the debate about whether or not a new territory will be free or slave comes up over and over again. And then we've got this turning point in attitudes about Native Americans that's underway by the 1820s. And by 1830, scientific racism has arrived and convinced many that assimilation is impossible. Right? So you've got the desire for more land and the debates about slavery and race that are happening over that land as we expand. And add to that manifest destiny and scientific racism, and essentially you get Indian removal, right? Americans begin to think that old policies for civilizing and assimilating Indians didn't work, even though there's ample evidence around them, among Native Americans, that they have assimilated in many ways. They begin to believe by 1840, most people think that Indians are savages incapable of becoming civilized. Old Indian policy had failed, so they were justified, therefore, in ruthlessly appropriating the lands of Native American and Mexican peoples, which is what they go about doing in the 1830s and 1840s. This is an example from the Southern Quarterly Review in 1845, so the same year that Manifest Destiny is coined in the Democratic Review, that text we read last week. To us, the Indian's destiny appears irrevocably sealed. He is incapable of civilization. He must wane away and be extinguished at last. What does that suggest? Michelle?
That Native Americans will never be like us. They will never be civilized. And it is our job to get rid of them because they're only a nuisance.
Is it our job or is it just going to happen?
It's inevitable.
It almost seems like it's inevitable, right? Like there's no, it's all kind of in passive voice. He must wane away. You know, maybe it's God, maybe it's fate, maybe it's race, but he must wane away. We're not actually going to do anything about it. It's just kind of going to happen. Emily, what were you going to say? And be extinguished at last, right? I mean, the notion by this point in time is that the inferior races will eventually disappear from the earth, one way or another. This is my favorite quote, the second one. The snow melts not more certainly before the meridian sun than the savage races of the earth before the advancing tide of civilization. Why do you think I like that? Not because I agree with it.
It really shows what's going on.
Okay, it really shows what's going on. And what's going on? What does it really show?
That everybody else is not us and we're the best. And you guys can't be like us. There's no way. So you should just go in your corner and go away from us. And you go over there. We might be there a little later, and we'll just push you a little farther.
Okay. So, but there's this sense of inevitability and of nature, right? It's not that we're actually going to go to war and send soldiers to uproot you and move you. You're going to melt like snow in the sun, right? The advancing tide of civilization are coming, and it's inevitable. Just as the sun rises and melts the snow, right? It's inevitable that you're going to melt away in front of us. So it kind of erases all of the violence that happens in between, and it naturalizes this whole process as if it's just a weather pattern, right? It's just as inevitable, right, as that. So a couple of maps up to the moment where we are, to 1830. This is a map of national expansion and the movement west. So the darker orange are areas of American settlement by 1800, and the lighter yellow is the places Americans have moved into by 1830. And the green are roads, and up here you see canals, the blue. So what does that reveal? What can you tell about what's happened between 1800 and 1830 from that map? Joshua?
We're expanding into our new territory that we just purchased.
Okay, so we're expanding into the Louisiana Purchase territory.
And eventually we're going to get over there. And if this keeps going on, eventually we're going to go into the Oregon territory and the Texas and the Mexico territory.
So you're talking about how Americans assume this is just going to continue.
Yeah.
This westward expansion. Okay, Michelle?
You also notice like the green lines represent, you said, were roads. So mm-hmm. I think it's like the first time that I think they labeled roads and actually established them.
Well, this isn't a historical map, but these are places where we know roads exist. But yeah, there's transportation routes, right? So it's connected back to that growing market economy, and it's ways for people to migrate, right? And the federal government invests in all kinds of transportation and communications technology by which we mean the telegraph at this point in time, in the years after the War of 1812. So here's another map. This is Native American land cessions to 1829. So even before Indian removal, through those treaties that the early presidents decide to negotiate alongside assimilation policies, they've already won land cessions from many Native Americans. So this dark green along the coast is what was ceded before 1750. And then the lighter green here is what's ceded just before and during the American Revolution. And then light green out here is partly land ceded before and after the Louisiana Purchase. And then all this yellow, right? All this yellow are lands that Native Americans have already ceded to Americans even before the time we get to 1830. So what does that tell you? Alongside successful assimilation, what else have Native Americans been doing? They've been negotiating treaties that did what? That gave up their lands, right? So if Americans have already, through treaty negotiations, sometimes after wars, right? This is not completely free of violence. We talked about some of the wars that happened following the Revolution and during the War of 1812. This is all, they've already ceded this much space. So you can see how white settlement is following many of these cessions, although some of them are further west. What else do you notice? Or what do you conclude from looking at these two maps? Joshua?
For some reason, I don't think that they just gave up their land. I feel like it was, you have to give us your land or else.
Mm-hmm.
More of, so that has nothing to do with the Native Americans being generous. It's just the Europeans being, we want that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that map doesn't represent nice Native Americans.
No.
It represents evil Europeans.
Okay. Not nice Native Americans, but evil Europeans, right? And that's essentially right. I mean, long before we get to the sort of most famous piece of legislation attached to Indian removal, this is already underway, right? Many treaties had attempted already to persuade the southeastern tribes who were moved in the 1830s to move further west. And in the 18-teens and 1820s, many of those groups, including the Cherokee, the Choctaws, and the Creeks, had set aside land west of, had traded lands in the east for lands west of the Arkansas, west of the Arkansas Territory. Jackson, Andrew Jackson, is elected in 1828 by Southern voters who expect him, among other things, to expel the Indians, right? And he knows this. He's been elected by widespread white popular support. And one of the things they want is land, and they want Indians gone, right? They are voting against assimilation when they vote for Jackson. So, and he argues that states, initially, he's hoping that this can happen state by state, have sovereign rights. Georgia is already trying to expel the Cherokees in a quite aggressive series of moves. And Jackson initially says, let's let the states do this, right? It's the states have sovereign rights within their borders. This is not federal government policy. Let's let the states do this. And Jackson also argues consistently that removal is better for Native Americans, right? Instead of recognizing that assimilation had in many ways been successful, at least for some Native Americans and some whites, he begins to say, actually, exposure to whites is bad for them, right? Exposure to white society degrades Native Americans, and they'll be better off if they go further west away from whites, who are too racist to accept them, who give them alcohol. There's a whole series of quite racist assumptions about Native Americans. But again, the idea that they're better off separate is an idea of innate difference rather than one in which people could actually live together. So there's a lot of opposition to Indian removal, both at the state level and then at the federal level, when the Supreme Court rules against that in the early 1830s and says, actually, the federal government, which has signed treaties with Native American groups and recognized them as sovereign nations, cannot allow states to make separate deals with them. This is a matter for the federal government to deal with. And as Jackson comes out in favor of Indian removal, there is opposition from Americans. Some of those folks we talked about a couple weeks ago, we were talking about the Second Great Awakening and reform movements. So the first time that American women have a mass petition movement where mostly white women, but also some Black and Cherokee women, sign petitions against the removal of Native Americans from the East and send them to Congress. And it's the first time women have sent petitions to friends in other towns and had thousands of people sign them and send them to Congress. Congress doesn't think much of women entering into politics in the late 18-teens and early 1820s, but there is ample opposition, and it's also coming from the clergy and from members of churches, especially Quakers and a few other groups who are opposed. They've been working on missionizing among the Native Americans under the assimilationist policies for a long time, and they've seen the success, and they don't think this is the right way to go. But ultimately, those folks don't win, right? I mean, they're largely associated with the Whig Party and with a relatively small group of northern middle-class folks who were involved in some of the other reform movements we talked about. And this cry against the unfairness of Indian removal is pretty much ignored, and Jackson goes about the business of making this into law. So he pushes an Indian removal bill, which basically gives the president the right and kind of the responsibility to negotiate treaties with Native American groups in which they cede all eastern lands and go west of Arkansas into Indian Territory, into what's now Oklahoma. He makes it a matter of party loyalty so that Democrats have to vote for it, or basically no one's going to play with them anymore in Washington. And it's finally signed into law in May of 1830. And that means that throughout the 1830s, the Jackson administration and the ones that come after him are going to negotiate treaties with Native Americans. And in some cases, Native Americans resist that in the courts. The Cherokees resist encroachments in Georgia in the courts twice. And through violent means, the Seminoles are the one group that fight a protracted war against removal in Florida, which we'll talk about in a minute. And what follows is what's known as the Trail of Tears. The point is, though, that, of course, Indian removal started long before 1830 and continued many years after. But this is the moment where it seems most clear that this is what American policy is. In 1831, it's actually the chief of the Choctaws who names this the Trail of Tears. He calls it the Trail of Tears and Death. And then in 1838, the Cherokee removal, the Cherokee call this the trail where we cried, the trail where everyone cried. So broadly then, Indian removal takes place from 1814 to at least 1858. These treaties, which we talked a little bit about last time, are interesting documents. And in almost every case, they're essentially political cover for forced and sometimes violent removal. And what I mean by that is that the government sends diplomats or Indian traders, Indian agents from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, from the War Department, into Native American communities to make these treaties. And they make them with anyone they think will sign the best treaty for the United States. So they're not looking for the most representative governing council. They're not consulting everyone who perhaps Native Americans think should be consulted. They're looking for people that they can persuade and that they can pretend to a minimally believable degree represent that group. And sometimes those people are given the right to stay where they are and keep their own personal property, like the sellouts that Maris has mentioned, if they will sign a treaty, meaning that the rest of the tribe has to leave. Among the Cherokees, this really splits people, and they become what are called the Treaty Party, made up of some Cherokees who actually just think, not necessarily this is the right way to go, but that it's inevitable, and they should make the best treaty they can make and get out while they can. That's led by John Ridge. He's actually opposed by Chief John Ross, whose house we saw earlier. John Ross does not want to sign a removal treaty. And there's violence in between them. There's also a story about how this is elites trying to become more elite by making a treaty that will benefit them more than the elites with whom they compete. But in Florida, we'll talk a little bit more about those treaties, but in Florida, the ultimate treaty that the Seminoles sign, the language is a little bit fraudulent. Like, the language suggests when they sign it that it's not final until they get approval from the rest of the tribe. But the United States treats it as though it is final once those eight chiefs have signed it. In exchange, they often get not just land in the West, but subsistence for a year, yearly annuities, cash payments in exchange for the money, millions of dollars in some cases for this land. So there is something given in exchange for the land and removal. The wrinkle there is that often Indian agents and particular members of a tribe will benefit more than everyone in that group, right? So the fraud goes on at multiple levels with these treaties. By 1837, 46,000 Native Americans have been removed from the East and sent to Indian Territory. By the end of the century, some estimate that over 100,000 people are displaced under this policy. They travel in a variety of ways. The Floridians that you read about today travel both by steamboat and on foot. The Cherokees travel by foot and perhaps on horse if they have horses. They are accompanied by armed military. There are lots of examples of individual violence and sexual violence along the trail. How many died is a difficult number to come up with, but probably at least 10,000 members of the five civilized tribes from the southeast who are removed die at some point in this process. Maybe 3,000 Seminoles die, but that includes deaths in the war as well as deaths on the trail. So that's a mushy number. Once they get to the West, anybody know anything about post-removal Indian life? What's life like in Indian Territory in the 1840s and 1850s?
Wasn't it kind of like a ghetto?
In some ways, it was kind of like a ghetto. What makes you say that?
Because, like, they're being forced into one area, and it was overpopulated, and it was... I don't know if it was dirty or disgusting, but I'm assuming it would be.
Well, it's not urban in the sense that a ghetto, I think we assume, is urban. But there is certainly a lot of poverty and disease. These are people who've been displaced from homelands where they have both sort of spiritual and, you know, kin connections. And they've all been through a collective trauma that's pretty horrifying. And there's also lots of violence among them. I mean, the Seminoles are forced into the Creek Reservation, and the Creeks don't want them, and the Seminoles don't want to be there. But the U.S. government is determined to make them somehow be together because the Seminoles descend in part from Creeks. And, you know, a lot of the land in the West taken for Indian reservations was actually taken from the Osage. So the Osage resent the presence of all these other Native Americans. All right, so this is a map of the southeastern removal, and you can see that throughout large chunks of the lower south, and what's moving into the lower south in this period? This is what we call the cotton frontier, right? This is where the folks from the upper south, on all that exhausted land that's not producing the same yields anymore, are going. And they're headed for Indian Territory, which is divided up in this way. So, at the end of the day, in the 19th century, Americans renege on the assimilation promise. And why do they do that? What are some of the explanations we have? This is a review of what we've just said. So why is it no longer possible to use the old assimilation policies?
Well, like we said before, they don't want the Indians to become part of their culture in, I guess, the smallest sense. They use race science as justification for that, saying there's no way that they could be like us because science says that they're not.
Mm-hmm. What else? What other demands or expectations do Americans have in this period that makes this less possible? Brittany?
They want their land. So basically, it doesn't even matter, I feel like, if they're Native Americans or some other race, they just want their land. So it's like, they don't really care as much.
Even if it had been Smurfs, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, it doesn't matter who they are. They just want them to leave.
Okay. So, in a way, all of this is political cover for a land grab.
Yeah,
right?
Basically.
And what are they going to do with that land?
Settle into it and make new farms or whatever.
Okay. And they're going to make money, right? Yeah. So, this is about land and money and racism and the demand for Indian land in that case. I'm going to speed through this. So then... Florida. You guys had a little bit of background on Florida in the beginning of one of those documents. But to review, in case that was not the clearest, the Seminoles are a group of Native Americans who form, actually, a new identity as Seminoles in Florida in the early 1700s. They're kind of refugees and remnants from other tribes that have already been pushed further south from white settlements moving into the seaboard south. So by the 1780s, there are people calling themselves Seminoles. And they're joined by some Creeks after the Creek War in 1814. Some of the lower Creeks, instead of going west, come south into Florida and join up with the Seminoles. So, and historically, historians have thought of them as the most militant, right? The Creeks who survived the Red Stick War, the Creek Civil War in that period, have really learned to hate whites and white encroachment, and they're sort of tagged as being the most resistant among the Seminoles. I don't think you really need to give the Seminoles excuses for being resistant, but that has historically happened. Florida is ceded from Spain to the U.S. in 1821. So beginning in the 1820s, at this exact moment, right, when we're looking for more land for cotton, more land for slavery, and safety for slavery below the lower South, Florida becomes American. Why do the Americans want the Seminoles removed? They want to control the land, but what's it really about, Michelle?
I caught something about like the slaves, like runaway slaves, and them wanting them back. And if they didn't get them back, then they would take the Native American slaves that they had in compensation mm-hmm. for the property that they lost, since mm-hmm. slaves are considered property. Or they would take monetary compensation or any kind of thing to make up for what they lost.
Yeah. So it's really, there's not like hordes of whites waiting to move into Florida. There will quickly be a new plantation belt in middle Florida, what's below, right below Georgia and Alabama, before you get to the sort of the panhandle. But there's not, you know, billions of whites dying to move into Florida. It's hot and awful and disease-ridden. The swamps haven't been drained yet. It's not the most attractive place, although it is certainly a frontier. It's really about slavery. Slaves have been coming into Florida from the South since the early Spanish colonial days. And so, you know, we often think of Canada and the North as the place where slaves escaped to, but until 1821, Florida was also a place that Southern slaves might escape slavery into. And whites have been angry about this for a long time. Going back to the Jefferson administration, they had been demanding that Spain do something to control the runaway slave population in Florida, that the Indians there be held accountable for it. And part of the negotiations they make with the Creeks following the Creek War is that they tell the Creeks, look, you're responsible for any of our slaves living among you, and that includes slaves who might live among people who were once Creek who live in Florida. So they make the Creeks responsible for any slaves living among the Seminoles. Now, part of the wrinkle here, right, is that because of assimilation, the Seminoles have adopted slavery. So some of these people are laborers they have bought. The other wrinkle, and this is a huge debate among historians, is that there are perhaps black Seminoles. There are people who had run away from slavery generations before, intermarried with Seminoles, and become part of Seminole society, who look African American to whites, but who identify as either bicultural, both black and Seminole, or as fully Seminole. If your mother's a Seminole, you're a Seminole. So there's some question among historians about how Seminoles treat their slaves. Are they treated the same as Southern slaves, or are they? Do they live in independent villages and sort of have their own chiefs and pay tribute? There's a lot of debate here. But the point is, there are people who look like slaves, who live among the Seminoles, and the whites in the South don't like this, both because they've lost property and they're mad about it and they'd like to hold somebody responsible, and also because they fear what an armed group of ex-slaves and descendants of ex-slaves and Native Americans could do on the southern border of the United States. Right? They're afraid. Remember how we talked about the Haitian Revolution? So they're afraid in Florida of the horrors of Haiti enacted all over again in this place where you have communities of Africans and Seminoles living together. So they signed several treaties in the first years of Florida's existence as an American state. And the first one, the Treaty of Moultrie Creek, signed 2 years after Florida becomes American, they set up a reservation in South Florida. So the Florida Indians had lived mostly up here in the northern tier and along the coasts. and they decide that they're going to make a reservation for them in Central Florida. You may have gathered from your reading that that reservation was not particularly hospitable. Nobody could actually live on the land, which is mostly swamp and some very poor agricultural land in that reservation. And so some Seminoles go, and then they come back and say, you can't live there. There's no way to survive. And they continue to live where they had lived before among the whites in spite of the treaty, because they can't survive on the reservation. In 1832, Americans bribe some Seminole leaders into promising that they'll consider moving onto the Creek Reservation in Indian Territory. So they find a few folks that are willing to make a deal with them, and they get them to agree that they'll go west and look at the land in Oklahoma and consider moving onto it. And they go, they take a delegation of, I think, eight to Oklahoma, where they make them sign the Treaty of Fort Gibson in 1833. The delegation is sort of coerced into signing once they're there. And again, this is the treaty I mentioned before, where it says, you know, upon consideration with the rest of the tribe, this will be, in a sense, a binding document. And they treat it as a binding document automatically. So what happens then is that as soon as the U.S., they say you have 3 years to remove in 1833, and by the end of 1835, the U.S. is moving troops and Indian agents into the territory and beginning to try to get Seminoles to come in and submit to removal, as they would say. And a substantial faction rebels. On the same day in December of 1835, Osceola, who will become maybe the most famous Seminole warrior, is part of a plan that murders the Indian agent at a fort in Florida and also murders Charlie Amathla, who's a Seminole who is willing to sign a treaty and remove. So he's a cooperative Seminole. And so the resistant and rebellious Seminoles kill one of their own who has threatened to cooperate with the whites, as well as an Indian agent. And that's followed quickly by an ambush of U.S. forces in Florida by a Seminole group, what whites call a massacre. Any battle that Indians win is a massacre in American history. So that becomes the Second Seminole War. There had been an earlier one in the 18-teens when Florida was still a Spanish colony, during which Andrew Jackson had been very involved in the fighting. And there'll be a later one with the few Seminoles left in Florida in the 1850s. But from 1835 to 1842, the Seminoles fight what is the longest, bloodiest, and most expensive Indian war. It costs something like $40 million, which is more than the U.S. had ever spent since or before on an Indian war. It ends in 1842, and the U.S. passes what they call the Armed Occupation Act, which is applies to any part of southern Florida not yet settled. If you go as a white person, the head of a household, settle on a farm, cultivate 5 acres, live there for 5 years, you can get the land for free. Not even under preemption, but the government will just give you the land. And that's the first version of the Homestead Act, which is passed in 1862, which you've probably heard of at some point. Yeah. That's the first version of the Homestead Act. The success of the Armed Occupation Act, which sounds a little bit more truthful about what it actually is than the Homestead Act. Right? These are armed occupiers. It's passed in Florida in 1842 and 43, and 1,300 people or so settle in Florida in that year under that act. So tell me about what you read. You read one account of Seminole removal from an Army officer who was accompanying the Seminoles on their way west, and this is just one small group of Seminoles. This is sort of the second or third major migration that the U.S. enacts in 1836, so the war is ongoing when that happens. And you also read an oral history passed down through generations of Seminoles about what it was like, what's remembered by ancestors about the moment when soldiers arrived and people are kidnapped and taken to be removed. Michelle.
I mean, what I really liked was that, I mean, they're two very different documents. Like, the oral history one depicted the white settlers as scavengers that picked up all the remnants of what the white soldiers destroyed. But then the lieutenant's journal really surprised me because it talked about how the men in charge of the Indian removal that, you know, traveled with the Indians, they also suffered just as much as the Indians did, and that it wasn't their intention to kill them, that it was just their intention to safely relocate them. I mean, in the terms of what safety required during that trip. But I think it was his on page 335, he says that each day I had equal, nay superior, difficulties to combat with, and that at no time on our journey had the morning opened with so fine a prospect of good day's journey. Like, even it rained every day, the wagons got stuck. I mean, he had to deal with the repercussions of that and deciding on whether which ones they should leave behind. He would stop every time the Indians or his men asked him to, because they wanted to bury the sick and dead. And he even purchased, I think it was on page 336, he said that the Indians were in want of beef, and he actually purchased a few, I guess, cows or whatever they were.
He calls them beeves, which is confusing, I'm sure, but it's just the term for beef cattle.
Yeah, so he purchased them for a very high price just because the Indians wanted it, and their kind of store or herd hadn't made it across the river yet, so he still did that for them, and he took care of them even though he was moving them and kind of...
So you're impressed by how decent he's being.
Yeah, okay. I was kind of shocked.
So you expected him to just be hateful and awful.
Yeah, and just to be like, you know, keep moving, like, kind of thing, like, don't stop, or he wouldn't give in to their wishes as much as I thought he would.
Hmm. Okay. Joshua?
I don't know if I believe him.
Okay.
I wouldn't mind seeing what a Native American was thinking about what was going on at this time, because as much as I would like to believe him, a lot of it just doesn't seem, unless he's just a really genuine and good guy, but for some reason, from everything we've been reading, I just don't think that he could be.
Hmm. Okay.
For some reason, I feel like he's like whipping them and still being like a terrible person.
Okay. Well, certainly he's telling the story, right? So he's not going to tell us anything that he did that he's not proud of, right? And he also is aware, since he's writing his superiors, that he's creating the record. Right, and that no Indian is going to sit down and be interviewed about what this was like, right? Like we actually can't have access to that voice in the same way, which is quite frustrating. Brittany,
I was just like going to say something along the lines of that. Like, I really don't think this is a real history because it's him. He's not going to portray American like army people that are doing this as like terrible, gruesome people. But it's more like the little things, like the Indians went out and bought like whiskey. I mean, they're certainly going to get back on that wagon on the next night, and he was like, no, I'll dump it out. And, like, it's just, like, the little things like that. And then over time, he starts to change, like, with the whole beef thing. But I truly believe, I think it's because his spirits are getting down, so he's just, like, more like, oh, I don't care. Like, you know what I mean? As long as some of us get there, I'm sure it'll be okay.
So this is interesting, because I think, do you think it's possible for good people to carry out bad policies?
Well, actually, definitely.
Definitely, right?
He's a lieutenant. He was given that position, and he was told that he has to do this, and you can't really defy your superiors unless you're looking to lose your position.
Right.
So he was kind of put in between a rock and a hard place, and I think he made the best of the situation, because it's not like he's sitting in a kind of a separate camp than the Indians. It's not like he is put up above them in any kind of better tent or so. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He's living in the same place that they are. He's dealing with the same things that they are. It's not just the Native Americans that are getting sick. His men are getting sick and dying, and he has to deal with it. And
okay.
I think he did a pretty good job of it.
So moving beyond him. Moving beyond, you know, this guy who's trying to maybe, I don't want to say make the best of a bad situation, but carry out his orders and keep these people alive, right? He's actually attempting to keep them alive. Beyond him, what happens to this group of people? Like, what is this journey like? What do you think this looks like from their perspective? What happens to them? What's the story? Mary?
It's like bad weather every day, they have problems every day, they're getting sick and dying. It's just like really terrible, every aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like seemed like anything that could go wrong did.
Yeah, it's this long, sort of awful journey, right? They're leaving New Orleans. So they've already taken a steamboat from Florida around the Gulf of Mexico to New Orleans, and then they're getting on another, they're going on another journey then up from New Orleans to Little Rock, right, by steamboat. And then from Little Rock, they have to get out and walk or ride in wagons, ride horses to Oklahoma. So, and all along the way, what kind of disease breaks out among them?
Measles.
The measles. And this, my sort of the most interesting part for me is the way he talks about them and the measles, because he seems to blame them for dying a lot, doesn't he? I mean, he's very frustrated that they will not accept the medicine that whites want to offer them as treatment for the measles, and he thinks that because they bathe in cold water every day, that makes them die of the measles. Anybody else notice that? So what did you think about that, Brittany?
I mean, I definitely can understand where they're coming from, not wanting to accept the whites. I mean, the whites are tearing you from your home. Are you really going to go accept something that they did?
Right, so it wouldn't really be rational on their part to say, yes, please give me some unidentified substance that will cure me of this disease that I have because you've ripped me out of my home and now I'm traveling in horrible weather thousands of miles. Okay, so I'm with you there. Do you even know? I had to look this up because I was really curious how whites would treat the measles. The measles is a virus, right? So what do you have to do to treat a virus?
You have to inject us kind of the vaccine, which is a weakened version of the virus. So didn't they used to cut out... I don't know. I remember this from the Ben Franklin show, too. Was that smallpox?
Right?
But did they treat
They don't have the same understanding of the measles, right? They don't think the measles is a... virus doesn't exist. Bacteria doesn't exist, right? None of this medical science exists. Penicillin has not been invented, right? Like, none of these things are possible. So they think that the measles is best treated... what he's trying to get them to take in this is calomel, which is mercury chloride, a naturally occurring form of it. That's the best treatment that they have available. So is taking that going to cure these people of the measles? No, absolutely not, right? I looked up some from an 1836 medical manual, some of the treatments for the measles that whites would have used. And there are like a variety of teas. Bleeding, cooling, purgatives, which is what mercury chloride would be, blistering on the sides or between the shoulders, so, you know, burning people, bleeding them, none of which is going to improve the situation, right? And then whites might have had something for pain relief, like opiates to sort of knock you out and control the coughing that comes along with the measles. So I just think it's interesting to think about that he's so sure that their technology, right, their superior civilization has the answer to the measles. And if these backward savages would just accept it, then they wouldn't have to die on this trip, right? I mean, in some ways he's trying to deny that they have, that he or the army or the United States has any responsibility for the fact that something like 49 of the 300 people on this journey are going to be dead by the end. I mean, that's a pretty high mortality rate. And so his, you know, and in his frustrations with them, all of these assumptions about savagery and civilization come out, which is sort of why I want to bring it up. Other things to say about the army document? Like, it's a pretty awful thing. When they want to stop and bury people, it's often their leaders. Who they're burying. So imagine that's happening. Michelle?
I mentioned also that he kept using the word obliged, which is kind of why I thought what I thought about him, because...
He means obligated.
Yeah.
More like, than he means like...
No, I know, that's what I mean. Mm-hmm. He's getting it from obligated, which means that it's kind of showing that it's his job to get these people there and get them as safely as he can. So that he is still doing his job regardless of what others think. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where I kind of got my notion from, was that word kept popping up, that he was obliged to buy them beef because they wanted it and mm-hmm. all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, by treaty, he probably is obliged. Yeah. And the U.S., again, right, uses the treaties and reports like this as political cover for what is essentially a fairly awful set of policies, and they know it. What about the oral account? I mean, one thing Michelle mentioned is that it's very clear from the oral account that when Native Americans are removed or attacked during the war, whites come in to pick up the pieces of whatever's left. And, you know, that includes food and hogs and things like that, which is, again, a great reminder that these people have things that white people want. They're not savages, you know, gathering berries in the forest. Brittany?
One thing that I think needs to be pointed out, which I also did in my paper, was... This was, like, written down in the 1970s mm-hmm. from, like, two generations word of mouth. And considering the fact this stuff went on in the 1800s, like, I don't really... I mean, yes, it's still going to be accurate. I mean, the stuff you can't forget. But at the same token, it's like, I think you need to take this with, like, a grain of salt.
Yeah, I think that's true of both of these sources, right? Oral history is certainly you have to think about The way that memory changes over time and all the things that had happened between 1838 or 1840, whenever this happened, and the moment when this gets written down. That's absolutely right. On the other hand, this is the closest we have to a seminal point of view of this moment, because they're not writing this down in the 1830s for posterity. And so I think it's important to include it. But just like we said, you know, the Army officer is not necessarily going to be honest about his own actions. This is certainly going to be from an Indian perspective. Joshua?
Oral history is kind of like the game Telephone, but over a long period of time where things change and things are completely... I mean, I would agree with this one more than the other one, but that's because I sympathize with the Native Americans more, and that's just my own personal bias. So... I would take it with a grain of salt, but like part of me doesn't want to, if that makes sense.
Other reactions to this?
I definitely think in this account of it, it really shows the fact that like the soldiers had more of a personal, like almost vendetta towards them, because it says stuff like pour bullets into each cult corpse and then like slit their throats and then do all this like crazy stuff and then go beyond it and like turn over the things that the women's were cooking and then destroy all their corn even though everyone's already dead. So it's definitely like they didn't need to do that. Like I'm pretty sure it's not written anywhere in some like army thing that to like go beyond it that much.
Yeah, that this represents a kind of excessive violence. Yeah. And that's borne out. I mean, I've read a lot, every oral history I can get my hands on about this particular moment. And it's borne out in many others. Now, that could be because these are the stories that get told and retold in groups of people. But there's ample evidence that this kind of excessive violence, that they not only come and destroy the village and kill the people in it, but they, you know, they kill the people in it three times over. You know, they slit their throats, they shoot bullets into them. And what's missing from this one is rape, which also happens quite frequently, not only in the war, but especially along the removal trail. Michelle?
I just wanted to say, like, it does show a lot of, like, obviously the severe extremes of which Americans went to when they rampaged these camps, but what got me, and I kind of compared both readings, was that in the chapter that you gave us before with the background information, it kind of did talk about how Native Americans retaliated and how they went back and burned American houses and killed American families and did basically the same things that we did to them. Mm-hmm. And that it just, like, I'm not trying to justify what Americans did because obviously it was wrong, but I just feel that a lot of the oral histories, I mean, granted, they're not going to tell you what they did wrong. They're just going to show that they were wronged themselves. And I just felt that that really wasn't fair as, well, I mean, nothing that we were really reading is fair, but that war is not one-sided.
Absolutely right.
And this, since this is taking place during the Second Seminole War, there have to be two sides, and that there, I feel like there are a lot of pieces missing. Mm-hmm. And that my question was that, you know, what did the Native Americans either do to deserve their camps to be rampaged, or what did they do afterwards? What did they do to retaliate? Mm-hmm. Because it just ends with them burying their dead and taking care of the wounded, but it doesn't tell them that they marched into American families' houses and killed them. And basically,
It's absolutely an exchange of violence. And one of the things that's interesting and awful about Indian wars is that homesteads, right, of Indians and whites are often the front lines, right? Because if what you're angry about are settlers encroaching on your land, then you're going to fight the settlers, not the soldiers sent to protect them necessarily, who outnumber you and have more resources than you have. So certainly there's an exchange of violence going on here. I mean, the other thing is that often when Seminole camps like this are attacked, it's in retaliation for an attack on a white homestead nearby, that soldiers are sent to rout any of the Seminoles nearby. So, and I think bringing up Indian violence is important too, because it reminds us that they did resist. These are not people who docilely got onto boats and went west after fraudulent treaties were signed by some members of their groups. They're people who resisted this at every turn. And that was apparent to Americans at the time, absolutely. Emily?
So there must have been like a remnant of these Indians when the soldiers came. How did they, I guess, escape the eye or domination of the soldiers?
Yeah, so around 5,000, 4,000, different accounts have different numbers. Seminoles are removed from Florida in this period. 3,000 or so, we think, died between the war and the removal process. You saw how high the mortality rate was during removal, and with these kinds of attacks happening in Seminole country over three wars, you can imagine. About only 500 remain in South Florida At the end of this war, and some of those get removed during the Third Seminole War in the 1850s. And what do? They go very far south in Florida, where there are still swamps. The swamps haven't been drained yet. That'll happen in the 20th century. And they hide. And in fact, Americans think they're gone for about 30 years, and they show up again in the 1880s and 1890s, coming into some of the early trading posts that end up in South Florida. Today, there are Seminoles in Oklahoma and Florida. There's a Seminole Nation in Oklahoma and a Seminole Tribe of Florida, and a smaller faction called the Miccosukees, who separated from the Seminoles in the 1950s in Florida. There's about 16,000 enrolled members of the Oklahoma Nation and about 2,500 Seminoles and Miccosukees in Florida. And, you know, these people are amazing survivors. When they come out of the swamps in the 1920s, they begin to serve the early tourism of Florida. And today, the Seminole Tribe of Florida owns the nationwide Hard Rock and worldwide Hard Rock Cafe label. So anytime you eat in a Hard Rock Cafe or gamble in a Seminole casino, those profits go back. And casinos have forever changed, perhaps, the economy of many Native American groups in the last couple of decades. It seems like mostly for the better. That's a whole other class, but it's a really interesting conversation. So great job, you guys. Thank you so much. And this is the end of Honors 186 today at the University of Hartford.